And that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. And on the show today, we're going to talk a little bit about guilty pleasures. We'll start out by talking a little bit about the general concept. Then we'll try it out by applying it to songs. And then we're going to use songs as we talk a little bit about holiday music. And then, of course, as always, we'll talk about what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's introduce around the table. Let's go this way. Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I'm a movies editor for NPR.org.
Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music, and I occasionally sit in rooms and argue about music until tables get overturned.
Yeah, it is that time of year. It's time for the best ofs, time for the high-level pleasures of the year to be selected. But this week, we're going to start off talking a little bit about guilty pleasures. Now, Stephen.
Yes.
The concept of the guilty pleasure is, of course, the thing that you don't really want to admit to people that you like, but that you actually like anyway. Tell me your general philosophy of the guilty pleasure.
I think this philosophy has become more common. My philosophy of the guilty pleasure is that there is no such thing. I believe you agree with me, correct?
I do.
Say, I agree with you, Stephen.
I always agree with you, Stephen.
That's right. That the notion of...
He's going to cut that part and replay it over and
over.
That's
right.
It's going to be a ringtone.
I was just going to say, that's my new ringtone. I agree with you. I always agree with you, Stephen. I always agree with you, Stephen. So, if you feel guilty about liking something, you're being a big dope. If you like something, own it. It leads to a lot of sort of phony opinion holding. Mm-hmm. Is if you feel like, well, this is the opinion that I can brag about having because it makes me sound smart. This is the opinion that I'm ashamed of because it makes me sound lower.
Right.
The question is, what's the origin of the guilt? Now, Trey, you have some lowbrow tastes and some highbrow tastes.
I don't know what you're saying, madam.
You have some of both. Talk to me about guilty pleasures.
Stephen's completely right. He's like...
My second ringtone. This is when Trey calls.
Pretending that you don't have lowbrow tastes is, you know, sort of presenting a Facebook version of yourself to the world. Entertaining this notion of a guilty pleasure and hiding the things that you don't want to admit that you take pleasure in is like, you know, polishing up that profile photo and mm-hmm. only, you know, posting the joke after you've worked it two or three times, Glenn Weldon.
just because Glenn hasn't said
and
much.
I wonder if
workshopping. It's called workshopping. Look it up.
I wonder if the concept of a guilty pleasure is more specifically an American thing, or at least a more specifically Protestant thing. Because if you parse the phrase, mm-hmm. we are, as Americans and perhaps as inheritors of the Protestant anti-pleasure legacy.
Oh, my God.
we're more conflicted about most pleasures, right?
All right. Well, I disagree with your definition of guilty pleasure because, again, when you're talking about whether or not you feel like you could tell other people about it, that has nothing to do with guilt. That's shame. That's humiliation. That's
public humiliation.
Yeah. Let's parse this. If it's a guilty pleasure, that means it's violating your own values.
It's something
that you like despite yourself. It's not about whether or not you can brag about it to other people. And I think there are legitimate guilty pleasures where the guilt is very literal and the pleasure is very literal. I'm talking here about... certain movies of a certain spicy nature. For us to have an interesting conversation, we need to talk about our own inner yardsticks. Also sounds dirty.
good God, people.
Okay. For this to be a useful conversation, instead of equating things like comic books as guilty pleasure, or in your case, Linda, romance novels as guilty pleasure, mm-hmm. they're not. We don't feel guilty about reading them.
No.
We have to think about what things kind of violate our own sense of worth, our own sense of what's good and bad, yet that we have, and I think this is important, a sincere pleasure in. This is not about ironic distance. This is not about something that's so bad it's good that mm-hmm. you enjoy by laughing at it. This has to be something that you actually take pleasure in, but you recognize that it is... Trey, you used the word lowbrow. I would use the words lacking in quality.
This is bad, but I like it anyway.
But if you like it, here's where I run up against my own...
Then by whose measure is it bad?
Your own.
Well, exactly.
Your own.
But if I like it, then it's not bad by my own...
Think about it. You like this in spite of yourself. That's kind of my definition.
Now, do you like it? But you like it, so it's not... It can't really be in spite of yourself. It can be in spite of a particular set of aesthetics which you may have worked to develop.
Mm-hmm.
And you like it because it speaks to some younger part of you or some part of you that you turn off a little bit when you go home from your day job or something.
That's getting close to it. That's getting close to it. It's something that sneaks past your defenses.
The only thing that I can actually imagine defining as a guilty pleasure, as in I feel somewhat guilty, but I enjoy it, is something like a Roman Polanski movie.
Mm, right.
You know, that's the kind of thing that I actually
if you find yourself
struggle a little bit with
sure.
morally. There are people who feel that way about like Chris Brown music or something
Tyler
like
the
that.
Creator,
stuff
or...
where you have trouble separating, as we've talked about many times, artists from art, which is a completely different question. But other than those questions, which actually implicate my ethics, I can't imagine a song, since we're going to sort of use songs as our example, that I enjoy listening to that I nevertheless feel is a bad song. I don't know. It's very strange.
Well, let's talk about specifics then.
And I will start with one, because what I tend to hear a lot about when people talk about guilty pleasures is things that they feel are fluffy or not substantive. Nevertheless, those are, to me, they continue to be absolutely critical parts of my listening and the things that I really, really enjoy. And I give an example. So that is Vacation by the Go-Go's, and that's the kind of thing you'll hear people talk about when they say that they're talking about guilty pleasure songs, because
really?
It's, yes, because you
feel like this is unmistakably a great song.
Mm, sure.
You do?
I do.
Yes. So you don't feel like anybody would claim that as a guilty pleasure song. I'm going to
bring up another argument, though. I'm going to bring up the argument that in this case, first of all, it's a great song. Second of all, I think it is impossible in many cases to separate what is viewed as a guilty pleasure from a song that is viewed as nostalgia-inducing.
Okay.
Part of the appeal of the Go-Go's is that this song is now roughly 30 years old.
Uh-huh.
And so you are going to associate it, you know, with your youth,
uh-huh.
with what you were listening to when.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was listening to this song when I was in grade school. My sister loved this song. You know, I used to bop around in footy pajamas to this song.
Maybe I'm not understanding what guilty pleasure songs are supposed to be, because this is my exact argument. My exact argument is there are people who would say, well, this is kind of low culture, but to me, I enjoy it. I love it. I love listening to it. I could listen to it anytime, many times in a row. Therefore, it's pleasurable and I don't find it guilt-inducing.
So I brought a song specifically in part because it does not harken back to any glory days for me.
Okay.
It is a fluffy song by a 15-year-old singer named JoJo.
Come with me, stay the night, just say the words, but boy, it don't feel right. What do you expect me to say?
You know it's just too little too late.
You take my hand and you say you've changed. But boy, you know you're begging, don't fool me. Because to you, it's just a game.
You know it's just too little too late.
So let me on down. This time has made me strong. I'm starting to move on. I'm gonna say this now. Your chance is coming.
Let the record show that here in the studio there is not just overbiting, but there is what you can only describe as R&B chair begging.
Yeah. So okay, what on earth makes that a guilty pleasure
it's
for you?
It's fantastic.
No, I'm not saying what makes it pleasurable.
Where's the guilt?
Now, see, Linda, I think you might be the wrong person to be asking this question, because you seem to be evolved enough not to care and not to have these feelings. But
believe me, we had a little earworm war
yes,
a few days ago,
which
began with me endless. Linda was over watching TV, and I was putting my daughter to bed, and I kept, trying to annoy her by singing the Rihanna song, We Found Love, which is one of my very favorite songs of the year, which I think is a completely fantastic song. And I had several responses from people who were like, how could you? Oh my God, that song is the worst. That song is terrible. How could you? Blah blah blah.
But Rihanna's that's not awful. Guilt. That's just peer pressure.
Right.
Yeah. That's again. That's not Which guilty. That's not coming from you. That's coming from other people.
Because it is enormously, enormously popular and very mainstream, and it's one of these unavoidable songs.
Okay. Well, what about the JoJo song makes you feel guilty?
I don't
see this.
I feel none.
We don't believe in.
But, we might have called each other maybe before coming in deciding on this topic.
Yeah,
maybe that would be a thing.
Right,
but I think it. Well, I think it stands as what would be viewed as a guilty pleasure. It is a it is a heavily auto-tuned, very mainstream pop song by a 15-year-old girl. It's not necessarily what you would call a critical darling.
So, as far as you two are concerned, the topic that we're discussing here is songs that other people consider guilty pleasures, but I do not because I'm evolved enough to have accepted them fully.
I do definitely have a certain amount of my own form of vanity in saying, I think this is awesome. And I think that's very common now in music critics' thinking. It's called poptimism, which is really twee, but it is a term that gets thrown around a lot among music critics.
I don't know how to bring a song and say, I like it, and yet it's not the kind of thing I like. If I like it, it is the kind of thing I like. And that's exactly, this is what I'm trying to understand. Help me, Glenn.
The closest I can get to understanding this concept is when I go to see a really big, stupid summer movie that makes no sense at all and has no pretensions to quality.
Real Steel?
No, you know, Real Steel, I think, is actually better than a guilty pleasure. I'm talking about something like 2012, which was just terrible on almost every front.
But did you enjoy it?
And it was an entertaining way to pass the time.
But
I do kind of, the guilt comes in because I kind of regret encouraging that kind of summer blockbuster a little bit.
Okay.
And I certainly regret spending that money.
Okay.
Right.
You regret spending the money. I mean, I would buy that JoJo song. I think I actually did.
All right. I brought a song, and I think everyone is going to recognize this. This might get us closer to the kind of territory we're talking about.
Of course.
Oh, this is so lowbrow.
I'm sorry.
This is Vivaldi.
I'm sorry, that's the Vivaldi. I think I gave Mike the wrong version of that song. There's Mike.
Are you supposed to play Il Divo?
Can I?
Well played, Trey.
Thank you very much. I think we can agree that there is more synthesizer going on there than is strictly necessary. But, you know, that's Laura Branigan. That's Gloria. She's a real voice. That was a big song in the 80s. I kind of like it because, you know, in my salad days, she was it. That song
in my salad
everywhere.
Days. This is my point about the Go-Go's.
Right,
and
so this is absolutely one of those things that pushes. And I'm not sure you would argue that that's a great song because it is. It is so very much of its time.
Look at Stephen Thompson pausing over there.
It is of its time. You can't listen to that now without sort of cringing at the synthesizer, the Europop synthesizer.
I wasn't necessarily cringing at it. I don't have the reaction to that song. I don't have the nostalgic snap in response to that song, even though it was around when I was a kid.
To this day, if somebody sings that at a karaoke bar or if it comes on, you know, kind of ironically in a bar that I'm in,
I will absolutely fling my hands in the air. There's a nod of recognition compared to, like, the Go-Go's, where I was immediately chair dancing, because it's the Go-Go's. It's awesome.
Glenn, do you feel like you understand what we're talking about?
I understand. It's always going to be a very personal thing. There's nothing. We're not going to be able to say, hold something up and say this is a guilty pleasure. Let me backtrack a little bit here. Stereotypes exist in the world. Stereotypes about specifically gay dudes exist in the world, and I certainly fall into some and not into others, and that's why I love my people, because we are not, ironically enough, homogenous. You might think we would be, but we're not. We each kind of conform to our own specific profile, and that's what keeps the gay world spinning right round like a record baby, right? Yes. And I'm very grateful for that. So one of the things that I don't happen to have, the little box that I don't check, is the show tunes box. I'm not a big musical theater guy, never have been. It's not that I disdain them, but, you know, it's the last thing in the world I would think to sit and listen to. It's just not who I am when I am sober. But
now it turns out, I'm beginning to understand.
It's on.
It
people.
Turns out when
yes. Songs I only like when I've been drinking. Yes. This I yes. can understand. Right.
So follow me here. So there is a show queen. The term is, by the way, straight people is show queen. There is kind of a show queen.
You are not allowed to use it.
That's right. It turns out it's buried about 5 or 6 beers in, though. And the way it manifests, I wished it manifested in some kind of fabulous way, but that's just not in my makeup, as it were. It manifests as me coming back from the bars and poking around YouTube for a Stephen Sondheim clip or a clip from Little Shop of Horrors. That's about as wild.
You wake up with your head on the keyboard. It's like, no.
There is, however, a song. I should actually call it a number because it's from. I can't call it a song. There is actually one song that has the power, even when I'm stone cold sober, to reach out and grab me in a special private place. I would love for it to be something austere and
like Joanna
and some kind of Gershwin, you know, Kurt Weill sort of complex melodies and atonal and...
Ladies and gentlemen, the melancholy beauties of September Song.
Something from some Russian operetta you've never heard of with tainted figs and toffee. Something horrible. Something...
Tainted figs.
I don't know. Something.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Something that you've never heard of and could not recognize and would not appreciate.
All right, enough with the wind-up.
Leave left room behind.
I was going to say that there's a ball. There's a ball in Glenn's hand that is eventually going to get thrown. But his arm is just going... There's a whirring
like
sound.
An animated character.
It's called a build-up. Look it up. The actual song that does it to me is none of those things I described.
I know that your powers of retention are as wet as a warthog's backside. But thick as you are, pay attention. My words are a matter of pride. It's clear from your vacant expressions, the lights are not all on upstairs. But we're talking kings and successions. Even you can't be caught unawares. So prepare for the chance of a lifetime. Be prepared for sensational news.
There we go. There we go. That's why I love this song.
Prepare for sensational news.
Right there. It's a little Charles Nelson Reilly. Yeah. There's a little Charles. There's a little Klaus von Bülow, let's be honest. Yep. And there's a little bit of Addison DeWitt right there at the end. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is Be Prepared from The Lion King, performed by the great Jeremy Irons. Why do I love it? The song itself and the arrangement is very sort of, you know, 90s people kind
sinister.
Of...
90s sinister.
No, it's like somebody trying to take on the Afropop worldwide. It's sort of fake Afropop worldwide.
Yes. Putumayo presents.
From all that build-up, I thought it was going to be like some like bunch God of showgirls. Yeah.
I am still me. Let's not get crazy. It's the performance. It's the way he says sensational news. I love it. I just love it. He's joined by both Cheech and Whoopi as backup hyenas.
That's true, yes.
Which, you know, they
as I recall, this eventually escalates into a chorus of hyenas, so Linda was not far off.
In fact, they do. I'll just throw in, while we're on this tangent, that the greatest Disney villains are gay or gay adjacent. Your Scars, your Jafars, your Maleficent Yzma.
I was going to say Maleficent.
Maleficent Yzma and Cruella DeVille, pretty much the same character. And, of course, your Ursula, all gay, all great.
This I can relate to. If we're talking about things that I don't particularly care about, except when I'm not in my right mind, then I can tell you the story about being at a work function in one of my previous jobs and singing along at a bar to Hard to Handle.
By the Black Crows?
Or? Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. See, a song you wouldn't normally listen to.
Oh, I would also throw out
my opinion thrown out primarily while drunk at weddings that the song Push It by Salt and Pepper is the single greatest song in the history of creation.
See, this is finally, we've arrived at it. You people, it's like pulling. Getting with you. God. I'm just going to say.
The trays tastes when drinking are the same as normally.
That's true. So.
Well, there is no. I mean,
trays just one big drunk id.
when it comes to music, I think.
This is true. I've kind of gotten to the point where Linda is, I think, where I don't pretend anymore that I get a great deal more pleasure from one end of the spectrum or the other.
The only thing I can tell you is I saw the Go-Go's earlier this year, and as I said at the time on Twitter, if I look as good at Belinda Carlisle's age as she does running around in black pajamas shaking a tambourine against her, her chest, I will be very happy later.
I never looked as good as
That's exactly right. It does seem that we struggle to come up with, short of altering our consciousness, we struggle to
come up with.
Well, I think you do find that there are certain songs that you don't realize you love until you are in a frame of mind in which your love of them can be unlocked. And the fact that the last time I was at a wedding, I at one point dropped to my knees on the dance floor to scream the lyrics to Living on a Prayer by Bon Jovi, which I had no idea. I mean, I think I knew that I went through a lengthy Bon Jovi phase in high school. I had my alarm clock. I had one of them fancy alarm clocks that set with a cassette tape. And Bon Jovi's Slippery When Wet was in that alarm clock for a good year.
I did the same thing. I had the cassette tape.
I'm going to sing Living on a Prayer.
It was a classical mixtape that led off with Tchaikovsky Overture, I think.
Of course it was.
Practically the same thing.
I'm never going to do karaoke. It's not in me. I'm never going to do drag, God forbid. But if, Trey, you among the people at this table, you would probably know best. Trey, is there a place I can go and dress up as a evil gay lion and lip sync this song? Is that what furries are? Because if that's what furries are.
I was just going to say, the furry convention.
Oh, I want. Wouldn't I'm it be great if at the furry convention there's like a
there's
room?
There's a karaoke night.
Like a room. That would be awesome.
It's a room full of people where all they want is to dress up and do Disney numbers.
The bare necessities. That would be awesome.
Furryoki.
Thank you, Stephen. But you guys aren't talking about guilty pleasures because there's a lack of guilt. There's a complete lack of guilt. Right. There's a complete lack of higher thinking.
No. This is true. This happened when I was listening to the audio and preparing for this because I was going to do some little homework and talk about why I thought Laura Branigan had some chops. Yeah. Turns out when you filter my iTunes folder on the word Gloria, what you get is Vivaldi, Laura Branigan, and then the Slava from Janáček's Glagolitic Mass.
You just Slava, made those words up.
No, I didn't. The Glagolitic Mass
is in
Czech, and Slava apparently means Gloria in Czech, and that's what you get. You know, I would have those three queued up, and I would play the Laura Branigan, and then it would keep playing into the Janáček, and I would have been gotten distracted by work, and it would keep going, and I'd just be humming along to that, too.
Excuse me, I just want to out you, if I may, as somebody who does not have, obviously, if the three things that come up when you punch in Gloria, in fact, you do not have Gloria Gaynor.
Right. Yes, well, I was filtering on song titles.
Oh.
Silly.
Okay.
Right.
Silly.
Silly. Dumbass.
Of course I have Gloria Gaynor.
All right, so if you have guilty pleasure songs, or if you can help us get to the bottom of what it is we're looking for,
help us establish a territory where this guilty pleasure concept might reasonably exist?
Exactly, other than at bars, which I think we have figured that much out.
Yes.
Feel free to come to our Facebook page at facebook.com/PCHH or come to the blog at Monkey C and talk to us about your guilty pleasure songs. Now, our other topic today that we were going to cover does also involve songs, but not so much guilt. This is the day we chat a little bit about holiday music. So, Stephen, I know that you have some fondness for holiday music.
I do. Conceptually, we're not just merely talking about holiday music. We're actually going to throw down some serious recommendations here, correct?
Right. Correct.
Okay, so we were looking for sort of definitive versions of holiday classics. And what I realized was that two of my absolute all-time favorite holiday songs are the same song. They're the same song covered by different artists.
Sure.
I have sort of my staples of holiday music, and what I've found is that the sort of overall defining characteristic of the songs is a note of melancholy.
Sure.
Because the holiday season, you know, for many people, not particularly for me, but for many people, is sort of a somewhat brooding, intensive time. What I find is that the end of the year is an inherently melancholy time, because regardless of how you assess your year, if it was a good year, it's over. If it was a bad year, it was a bad year. And if nothing happened, nothing happened.
Yeah.
So the end of the year is sort of whether you attach Christmas to it or not.
You bring me down.
I know.
Well, that would technically be the first 6 days or 7 days of Christmastide.
Whatever. yes, I'm sorry. The first 6 or 7 days of Christmastide are an inherently melancholy time. And so a lot of my favorite Christmas songs and holiday songs are inherently melancholy. You're Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, Joy to the World, or, you know, Silver Bells, you know, a lot of the kind of Silent Night, you know, a lot of the sort of more hymn-like songs tend to attract me more than your Frosty the Snowman, your Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, so the sort of peppier and more secular they are, the less they tend to interest me. But both of the songs that count among my favorites of all time are covers of Little Drummer Boy.
Yep. I knew where that was going.
Which, I'm sure you know one direction I'm going with this, which is your Bing Crosby and David Bowie.
Sure.
Which is probably my favorite moment of Christmas culture in the history of the world.
Yeah, it's super fantastic.
And I was thinking some enterprising genius needs to recreate that scene with David Bowie as the elder and some young whippersnapper, maybe a Russell Brand as the young whippersnapper. Mike, could you play a little Peace on Earth / Little Drummer Boy for me?
Actually, our family do most of the things that other families do. We sing the same songs.
Do you?
I even have a go at White Christmas.
You do, huh?
And this one. This is my son's favorite. Do you know this one?
Oh, I do indeed. It's a lovely thing.
They told me, ba-rum-pa-pum-pum, a newborn king to see, ba-rum-pa-pum-pum. Our finest gifts we bring, ba-rum-pa-pum-pum, rum-pa-pum-pum, rum-pa-pum-pum. Peace on earth, can it be? Years from now, perhaps we'll see.
I could just listen to Bing Crosby talk like that all day. Oh, I think it's marvelous.
Yeah, I have to say, you know, the banter is surprisingly laid back and charming.
It's really in that setup. It just immediately kind of slows the blood. There's this sort of minor key notes behind it that's just immediately transporting.
And who's your other one?
The other one is also of Little Drummer Boy. This is probably my favorite holiday album that does not include Chipmunks by the band Low.
Those are your two Little Drummer Boys.
Yeah, just beautiful, beautiful, beautiful versions of a song that I don't necessarily immediately think of as that's my holiday song.
A song that, quite frankly, can be insufferable in the wrong hands.
Can.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
But
absolutely.
Not in those hands.
When you said which song it was, I was like, ee.
My favorite Christmas song is Wonderful Christmas.
You know, it will come as no surprise to any of you, I don't think, that I am totally with Stephen on this idea that minor key, vaguely melancholy Christmas songs are the best kind of Christmas songs.
Not a surprise.
In the Bleak Midwinter is a big favorite of mine. There is another text called, and a lot of people don't think of it as a Christmas song, it's Let All Mortal Flesh Keep Silence, which is a really, really old liturgical text, and it is most often set to a French tune called Picardy. Again, a minor key melody, although one of the things I like about it, and this one I brought as kind of a guilty pleasure, because some arrangements bloom out into a kind of major key sunburst for the climax. climax at the end. Either way it's arranged, it's got tremendous authority. It's kind of a shock and awe hymn. Not so much melancholy as tremble and despair ye in the presence of God, ye people. You know, there's these lyrics about cherubim with sleepless eye flanking the coming God who's coming down to earth our full homage to demand. Technically, it's an incarnation hymn. It's from a text that was about transforming the blood into wine. The guilty pleasure setting I brought is this really, really grandiose choral setting by Gustav Holst, the guy who wrote The Planets. And it's often sung during Advent in the run-up to Christmas to help congregations get in the God is coming frame of mind. And it ends up with the choir kind of thundering along and in at least eight parts. And there's a big double amen tacked onto the end. So as kind of a Christmas guilty pleasure, I spent about 5 minutes looking on YouTube to find the glitteriest recording I could find, and this is it. That's one of the less refined versions of Let All Mortal Flesh Keep Silence. So, and my third choice is not at all minor key. There's a kind of a personal connection. I'm not going to tell you what it is because you'll recognize it, I think. I like it because, A, everyone likes it, and because my mama went to school with the person who made the song famous in around the third and fourth grade, I think it was. It's been famous for a long, long time, but when I was digging around to find out more about it, I discovered that it was not an instant hit. It
originally came out in 1958 and absolutely did zip. The next year, I had a pretty good-sized record with Sweet Nothings, and they re-released Rockin' Again, and it did pretty good. And then the next year, 1960, I had I'm Sorry, and they released Rockin' Again, and it did great.
Got a musical hint for you.
It's Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree.
Well done, Glenn Weldon. Wow. That song, if I am not incorrect, that song has been the number one Christmas song more years than not since 1960, and due in part to little passages like this.
Holiday. Everyone dancing merrily in the new old-fashioned way.
So that's Brenda Lee, of course, and the voice you heard earlier was Brenda Lee, who I talked to earlier today from her home in Nashville.
Oh, cool.
And you know, we talked a little bit about what she likes about it, and the great thing about that conversation was that she talked about the band members. She didn't talk about herself. She talked about how great the saxophonist was and how great the guitar player was and how great the drummer was. She says she never gets tired of hearing the song, which is kind of amazing to me. In fact, she apparently still sings it at the end of her shows, no matter what season it is. it's always the encore, right? Like June, which I think is kind of cute. I asked her to settle one question that has always troubled me, which is that I said, Miss Lee, if you and your family were rocking around your Christmas tree, what is the correct direction?
What is the correct direction?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, my gosh. South, of course.
South. Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Brenda Lee.
Very, very nice.
That is my new ringtone.
I approve. Thank you very much, Trey Graham.
You are welcome.
Glenn Weldon, Holiday Music.
Okay, here's mine.
They got cars, big as bars, they got rivers of gold. But the wind goes right through you, it's no place for the old. When you first took my hand on a cold Christmas Eve, you promised me Broadway was waiting for me. You were handsome.
You were pretty queen of New York City.
When the band finished playing, they held out for more. Sinatra was swinging, all the tunes they were singing. We kissed on a corner, then danced through the night. The boys of the NYPD choir were singing, go away, babe. And the bells are ringing out for Christmas.
Christmas Day.
All right, so that is Fairy Tale of New York by the late Kirsty MacColl and the remarkably still not late Shane McGowan of the Pogues, who is still kicking.
Shane McGowan, still alive.
Still alive. His liver.
Think of all the people who died too young, and then think about the fact that Shane McGowan.
I hesitated to pick this, even though I love it very much, because it is kind of the default hipster Christmas pick.
Yeah.
But and it's been covered by everybody from Coldplay to Third Eye Blind to... Katie Tunstall. There's also fans of the Venture Brothers should seek out online the version by The Monarch and Dr. Girlfriend. That's a lot of fun. It does contain, famously, a gay slur, but in my opinion, if you preface this particular gay slur with the phrase, you scumbag, you maggot, you cheap lousy, I think you get a pass. especially if you are Kirsty MacColl in 1987.
I gotcha.
And you are.
There is another version of this song, and there's many versions of the song, but lately when I've been kind of talking up this as a particularly great Christmas song, people in the last couple of years are pushing back with, well, you know, there's a version by Florence Welch and Billy Bragg that's really good too. Florence Welch, of course, from Florence and the Machine. I'm a big fan of both those performers, but listen to this.
They got cars, big as bars, they've got rivers of gold, but the wind whips right through you, it's no place for the old. When you first took my hand on a cold Christmas Eve, you promised me Broadway was waiting for me. You are handsome.
You were pretty, queen of New York City. When the band finished playing, they yelled out for more. Sinatra was swinging, they were singing.
We kissed on the corner, then danced through the night.
And the boys of the NYPD choir were singing Galway Bay. And the bells were ringing out for Christmas Day.
Okay, so this is incredibly lugubrious, and I understand what they're going for. They want to play up the plaintive sadness of the song, but the song is already sad. The song is already melancholic. You are gilding the junky alcoholic lily of this particular song in a completely unnecessary way. So I'm still sticking with Kirsty MacColl and the Pogues. Fairy Tale of New York is the best Christmas song ever.
Excellent choice. Excellent choice. I brought my favorite Christmas song, which has been my favorite Christmas song since I listened to choral versions of it and other things when I was a kid. It's always been my favorite. It was my favorite to sing. Let's hear my pick, which is by Sufjan Stevens.
Jesus, our brother, strong and good, was humbly born in a stable. Jesus, our brother, strong and good. I said the donkey, shaggy and brown. I carried his mother uphill and down. I carried his mother to Bethlehem town.
That is The Friendly Beasts, which, like The Little Drummer Boy, is sort of from the manger scene. It's sort of a song about the manger scene. And in this one, the animals who are in the sort of barn do various things to be helpful during the birth and with the baby. And the doves sing and the other animals give up blankets and things like that. So for some reason, it's always been to me the most resonant Christmas song. And so that has always been my favorite. And I discovered this version on Sufjan Stevens' holiday album, Hark, Songs for Christmas, which I definitely recommend. There's a ton of really beautiful stuff on it, but I recommend that one in particular. It's a very special favorite of mine. And
it also has Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing, which you guys played.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. So that's definitely my absolute favorite. I have heard many, many versions of it, but none that I like better than that. So that was my choice. Mm-hmm. My choice.
Excellent choice.
Awesome.
That whole record's wonderful.
Yeah. So those are our holiday choices. Obviously, come to Facebook or the blog and give us your holiday choices. And that brings us to our final chunk of our show, what is making us happy this week. Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
Well, I want to thank an alert Pop Culture Happy Hour fan on Facebook. Please like us if you haven't already.
Right.
Named Sarah Kost, or Kost, K-O-S-T, who recommends a Tumblr that has just made me giggle and giggle for the last 24 hours or so. It is rogersphotobomb.com. That is R-O-D-G-E-R-S. photobomb.com, which is photos of various Green Bay Packers standing on the sidelines during games. Why the team captains. So you have three dudes with their chests puffed out standing on the sidelines. And behind them is quarterback Aaron Rodgers, who has found ways to photobomb them, by, you know, which is where you try to present yourself in other people's photos.
You sneak into the photo.
You sneak into the photo.
You mug behind them.
And so what you have is this string of photos that get funnier and funnier and funnier as you view them cumulatively, of a little Aaron Rodgers head sort of mugging and goofing off behind these sort of serious looking Packers.
Yes.
And if you don't already love the Green Bay Packers as I do, or you don't already love Aaron Rodgers as I do, you will just adore the big goof after seeing him like put cups over his eyes and goggle behind behind various Packers. And when he is one of the team captains, he has his backup Matt Flynn do it, and they often appear together, like they'll try to insert their heads sort of equidistant. Rogersphotobomb.com. It just made me laugh and laugh.
Very, very good. I like it very much. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Well, I got to talk to Brenda Lee today, so that was nice.
Sure.
The Broadway musical Follies, which you may have heard me talk enthusiastically about, it was announced today that it is going to get a run in California after its limited Broadway engagement closes.
Very good.
So that's making me happy. But I think what's making me happy most this week is that I have in my dirty little hands, on my desk, is a screener for Smash. The upcoming NBC mid-season musical drama about the creation of a Broadway show.
That's wonderful.
Based on the life of Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, my goodness.
It stars Deborah Messing from, you know, Will and Grace.
Yes.
Who is getting a very different kind of part here, which is very nice. It stars a number of people who are very interesting, including Angelica Houston. It stars a young woman named Megan Hilty, who is a legit stage musical performer, and who, based on the evidence of the pilot, might just be stealing a little bit of the Catherine McPhee thunder when this thing premieres.
Because it also features Catherine McPhee.
Because it also features Catherine
American
McPhee.
American Idol runner-up.
Yes.
I didn't realize there was Catherine McPhee thunder.
Mm-hmm. There is. Well, oh my God, they are so centering the marketing of this show around her.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds suspicious, and it does have sort of faintly alarming whiffs of McPhee and Glee around it.
Mm-hmm.
But it is being
McPhee.
You know, there's some auto-tune going on in there, so I'm not entirely cautious pleasure is what's happening here. It's being produced or executive produced by the team of Zidane and Marin, who were behind the movies of Hairspray in Chicago, and Mark Shaman is an executive producer. Steven Spielberg is an executive producer on this. There's some resources there, and it's one of the more promising looking things in the winter midseason. I'm kind of curious. So
great, excellent, Glenn Weldon. What's making you happy?
Keeping with the theme that I had going early on in this podcast, some of the clips that drunk Glenn would find himself going 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning. I've talked to both Trey and to Mondello about this series of YouTube clips. Just type in Sondheim Masterclass.
Oh, yes.
And
what, you will find are clips from, the sweaters date it to about 1978,
yes.
79. The high-waisted jeans and the terrible hair date it to around 1979. He is sitting with a bunch of actors who are going over and trying to sing some of his songs, and he keeps stopping them and saying, okay, let's go back and try it again. Here's what I was trying to get to at the song. Here's what you need to convey in this song. It struck me as remarkable for a guy who has such a reputation as kind of a prickly guy. He is remarkably humane and kind and self-deprecating. He will talk about how in the song Send in the Clowns, there's a part where he wrote the lyric, "Don't You Love Farce?" And he regrets it now because a singer really needs to hit "Don't You Love Farce?" And so he makes the person go back and do it. But it's filled with generosity. There's a section here where he's talking about the song Not Getting Married Today.
Joined to wife, the heart sinks down at first day.
Hold on one second. Let's get some color into the word dead there. Dead. Heart sinks down and feels dead. I mean, let's push it in. But she's hearing you in her head, and what you're saying is, darling, it's worse than you think it's going to be. Much worse than you think it's going to be, okay? So you're emphasizing her insanity, so really push it at her. Very pure, but push it out. Once more, do your little bit.
It's just remarkable for me to see him be so kind to, in some occasions, you'll see some of the actors can't really sing or they kind of miss the notes, and mm-hmm. he's not concerned about that. He wants them to hit the lyrics.
Yeah.
Yeah, this really, is a, really hard. This is a song characterization, a song interpretation class that is one of the better examples of its kind.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fantastic.
And while you're YouTubing that, I'm going to also say that anyone who has not already YouTubed Judi Dench singing Send in the Clowns,
yeah.
please YouTube it right now. Trey and I will not do our 15-minute routine about how amazing it is, but we could. Judi Dench, Send in the Clowns. You will not be sorry. So that is what is making Glenn Weldon happy this mm-hmm. week. Stephen Sondheim. Well, what is making me happy this week, I am in a very heavy winter movies push. I am pushing through a bunch of stuff that I have missed in addition to a bunch of new stuff. One of the things I saw over the weekend was Moneyball. And the particular small thing that made me happy about it was the performance of Chris Pratt, who I've talked about before, who is on Parks and Recreation, who is one of my favorite really, really hysterically funny, big, funny performance actors on television right now. Maybe my funniest person on television right now, possibly. And in Moneyball, he plays a not comedic role, and it's very small, and it's very simple. And it was a great example of somebody who, you know, stepped away from what they were doing that they were most well known for and went and did this small part in a movie that really opens up another piece of his persona. And I think in some of the other work that he's done in the past, some of the other TV that he's done, he's been more like that. He's been more of a quiet, sort of sweet-hearted guy. But to me, seeing him in Moneyball, which I did enjoy quite a lot, was just a nice example of seeing somebody do something different. And it always makes me happy when an actor that I really, really love in one thing does something that's really genuinely quite different. And so that performance made me very happy this week.
Awesome.
And that brings us to the end of our show. So you can obviously find us on Facebook or find us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn Weldon at GH Weldon, that's WELDON. You can follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, who played MVP today, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our kicky in and out music. So thanks to all of you for being here as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.